Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Testing. 1, 2, 3. Hey, everybody. It's Sunday. It's the main course. We're engineered in there by Joe Galarraga. Joe, are you there?
Hello. How are you?
Hey, how's it going? How was your weekend so far?
It was great. I went to a wedding last night.
Oh, very nice. Did you perform?
No, I did not. I was just a guest.
And was it good?
It was wonderful. It was a beautiful ceremony.
Was our Heritage radio party better?
Of course.
Oh, very nice.
Of course.
Talk to me about a raise later, Joe, after the show. I'm very, very happy that radio party was so great. It was just the best. Roberta's did an unbelievable job. They were so generous. The staff couldn't have been nicer. All the hosts showed up. We had all these restaurants, Gramercy Tavern, Parish Hall, Del Posto, all, you know, with their head guys right back there, you know, serving stuff up and explaining it. I think we signed up like 80 new members or something like that. Is that right, Joe?
Yeah, I think that's what I heard from Aaron and Jack.
Aaron and Jack. All right. Well, 80 members. As everyone knows, we are a membership-based organization. We have a few hundred members. And the best thing about being a member, of course, is the benefits you get. Aaron and Jack and Joe have been doing a great job getting local businesses to offer discounts and perks and special features and inflated social status to people who are card-carrying members. So, definitely sign up, $60 for 1 year membership. I'm so excited about today because, you know, a real kind of mentor figure of mine is on. His name is Denny Abrams. And, you know, he's taught me to look at and see all these things that I had heard about but never really thought about. So when I was working with Slow Food in Italy, Carlo taught me about this concept of slow cities. And I never really knew what that meant. But after meeting Denny, he kind of distilled it for me. We actually met working at, I came out to San Francisco, to Berkeley, to work Alice Waters' 30th anniversary for Chez Panisse. And she got a lot of the people to give up their back, you know, kind of yard room, yard house, yard barn to people who were coming in to volunteer. So I got checked up in Denny's yard and, you know, we got to know each other and became friends. And, you know, once I talked to him, I learned how much I love Portland, for instance. Everything's one or two stories tall. It's built to scale. You have these kind of horizontal neighborhoods that are just real social clusters of bakeries and warehouses and artists working, and it's just really just such an unbelievable city for me. And I wouldn't have really put that into words if it wasn't for Denny. And then I live on near in Cobble Hill, and this Court Street is a very major street, and so is Smith Street, and somehow Court Street just works. It's a lovely place to walk and shop, and Smith Street, one block over, is just not. It's just not as nice as Court Street, and why is that? And, you know, Denny taught me to look at scale and how far apart the houses are to each other and what's the height of the house and is it built on a human scale and, these things that, I didn't always think about. And it brought me back to my memories of Jane Jacobs and how much I loved her, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. Anyone who has not read that book has to read it. Basically, what else have I written? You know, the curvy streets of London. I know Paris is so beautiful, but there's something about the human scale of a small city with people sitting on their windowsills, on their stoops, kids playing on the street, stickball, that, really fascinating. And Denny opened my eyes to all that. Even the Seagram's Plaza, I think that's 49th and Park Avenue. It just works. The building, the high rise is inset from the street. There's a huge fountain. People sit, they congregate there, they eat their lunch there. Anyway, all things that I've learned from Denny. So he's in studio with us, which is a real honor. So welcome, Denny.
Hello, Patrick.
So talk about transforming of neighborhoods. You are the founder, basically, of 4th Street, a major business district in downtown Berkeley. So you have been part of that for decades. So talk about how that neighborhood and how you transformed it and the steps along the way.
Well, first of all, it's not in downtown. It's in West Berkeley. It's near the freeway. So I started it in 1978. I bought some bombed out buildings from the redevelopment agency, and my vision was, which we did for the first 5 years, was to create a building design center where craftsmen, glass blowing, stained glass, woodworking tools, architectural offices, textiles for the home, furniture making, cabinet making, all keyed into the local remodeling industry. And I wanted to create a modern version of a 15th century guild. We were building these beautiful handmade houses in the Berkeley Hills, recycling lumber, etc. The first ones to do that. And then it just grew over time into something else and morphed into a major shopping area. Now we have an Apple store and about 200,000 square feet of retail shopping and restaurants.
So did you think the guild idea would be profitable and make good business sense in the long term, or were you just passionate about the arts?
No, I think when you build something like that, you're just passionate about. I was passionate about making beautiful buildings, and I'd worked in research with Christopher Alexander on the pattern language.
Is that that's his book?
It's a very famous
seminal book. And what is the basic thesis of that book?
Well, it's it started out. We got a grant in the '60s. Late 60s, to bring the behavioral sciences to bear upon architectural design. And so we had to create a structure for that. And that's what the pattern language is. So worked on that. And the conclusion from that was, if you want to make something beautiful, you're going to have to build it. So I went out and bought a pickup truck and started building.
What were the various iterations? Do you have some major, you know, what were the late 70s, early 80s, late 80s, 90s? How did it go from a, you know, medieval guild idea to having an Apple store? And, you know, how many businesses? I mean, there's dozens of businesses on
that
street.
Yes, there's at least 85 different vendors and restaurants now. But it sort of grew organically, and that's why it's great and works so well, because it just didn't get laid down the way a modern shopping center. What they do now is 18 months, they put down 300,000 square foot mall, and they expect it to be interesting, and it doesn't hook into the community, the economic base, the aesthetic base, that's what's wrong with modern architecture, is that the process is off, and that's what has to be redesigned. Not buildings, it's the process of how the buildings come into being.
Well, I mean, there's also, you don't give yourself enough credit almost, I mean, there's also a selection of the mix. Right, of because this is about clusters of businesses working together, right? So, I mean, how did you think about that? I mean, is that Did you just put yourself in the shoes of the consumer and what they would enjoy?
I always sort of went for what I liked, and I didn't do focus groups or any of that. And I always tried, and independent retailers are much more interesting than the chains, but there are some goods and products which only come via the chains. The first thing you have that I understand about retail is that no one really needs to buy anything for the next 3 years. They bought it all last year and the year before and put it in their garage. And so then you have to ask yourself, what is shopping all about? And it's really about a public experience. And shopping, half of shopping is almost an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And so... now, I see that as my job as the developer of this, as the one who sort of creates, makes sure that people have a great public experience.
So what is the importance of food to that public experience?
Oh, it's, well, the first restaurant I built there, I was doing the building design center, and I called Alice Waters, and I said, I've got this little space for 60 seats. Do you know anyone that wants to do a little restaurant?
And well, you had been in restaurants. Your parents were involved in the restaurant, so that was normal that you would come up with that thought, because you grew up in that industry a little, or no?
No, I just realized that we needed food there to make the experience of the building design center more interesting.
So what did she say?
And she sent Mark Miller.
Okay.
And I met Mark Miller, and we opened the restaurant, and the concept was a French truck stop, but it was all Southwest cooking. And within 2 months, I was having lunch with James Beard, who told me that only 25 people in the entire nation can cook like this.
Who is it? Is that Taco Bayou? No, wait,
no,
what's the name of this restaurant?
It was 4th Street Grill.
Oh, 4th Street Grill, sorry.
And we got a review in the New York Times, and that sort of put the whole place on the map. So restaurants have the power to really make a neighborhood.
They do. And what's a legendary coffee shop there, the diner that you people have breakfast at and lunch?
Betty's Diner. It's been there for 30 years. It's really fabulous food, and it's built on the concept of the diner.
The diner. And then, of course, there is Café Rouge, which is a butcher shop and restaurant. There's Zoot, which is right next door.
Right.
Which is an Italian fare and just fresh.
And then there's an Asian restaurant, Oshame, with David Vardy as the chef. And then there's an old line restaurant that's been there for 80 years, Spengers, but it needs to be revitalized.
So what is successful about that space? I mean, for one, as you say, well, it's a horizontal mall. It's not a vertical one. So, you know, people walk along a street and there's benches and it's on a human scale. I mean, can you talk a little bit about the success of public spaces versus the failures of them and scale and things of that nature?
Well, first you have to understand why public space is so important. I think there's no place like New York where you see the importance of the street to a society. New York without the street would be nothing. I mean, you wouldn't want to be here. And I think as much criticism as Giuliani has gotten, he did recognize that people needed the street back. And he gave that back to New Yorkers, and New York's one of my favorite city, and it's all because of the street. And the street is an expression of real democracy. It's the architectural expression of democracy, because the street belongs to everyone. And you ask anyone in New York, whether you ask the doorman or the CEO of a Fortune 500, what does he like about New York? And it's that walk down the street. that belongs to everyone equally. And so I understand that about the street, and the success of my street that I built is because it has benches and it caters to everyone. It's not private space full of security guards. It's really a public space mm-hmm. that belongs to everyone. It also, I grew it in 8 different phases of construction. And so it grew up in this incredibly wonderful organic way. Mm-hmm. And the new urbanists who've been around for 10, 15 years trying to create spaces like this are never really successful because they try to create it all in 15 months, and there's something that's lost in that process. Hmm. Is when you do it in these small incremental phases over a 30-year period, you get real roots in the community, economic roots, and then each phase of construction relates to the previous phase and things change. And it all sort of knits together the way old towns and cities have always knitted together.
Hmm. Over time, if you even, I don't know if this number's ever been calculated, but what is the total economic impact of 4th Street? I mean, all the vendors together and their revenues.
Well, we know what the numbers are. There's sales of over 80, 90 million. Now with an Apple store, will be another
180. It'll yeah. double it. Wow, fascinating.
Apple stores are amazing.
$90 million. Unbelievable. Well, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with Denny and expand it a little bit and talk about neighborhoods in America, Berkeley and Oakland, and the influence of the 60s.
Pastures is a 146-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Hey, Joe, who was that on guitar?
I don't know who was on guitar, but that was the Four Lincolns, one of Aaron Fairbanks' cousins.
Really? Well, I'll say, I always said there should have been more Abe Lincolns. So any band that names itself the Four Lincolns is a friendly band to me. Well, that was very interesting radio. I mean, send that one to NPR Awards or James Beard Awards. That was, you know, I didn't overtalk. I didn't go off on tangents. Denny answered interesting stuff. You know, we're usually a food show, so it's interesting to hear this perspective distilled so perfectly. So, Denny, I know you're a man that travels. You've lived in many places. You're born in Germany. You lived in China. You lived in... you know, you live in New York sometimes, Berkeley, of course, and you travel a lot. You just like to travel and eat and experience the world. What are the best neighborhoods in America, to your mind?
Well, I like these small scale neighborhoods. New York is one great neighborhood after another, so I won't go through those. Mm-hmm. But, if you go to Boston, Newbury Street, if you go to Washington, it's Georgetown, and in San Francisco, it's Fillmore Street, in L.A., it's Los Vilos, maybe even Colorado Avenue.
I love 18th Street in San Francisco.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes, sir. The Mission, the Valencia district. That's really... And it's very interesting what's going on there. I don't know if you are familiar with a group called Main Street Alliance. There is a person who has been studying local economy and advocating the strength of local economy. And the Valencia neighborhood in San Francisco... has chains have to get special use permits to locate there. And so they want to leave as much opportunity to local businesses as possible. And it's a very interesting take on this. So,
and what about the world? It's everywhere, I guess, in Europe, right? I mean, there's not a place that doesn't have that.
Yeah, Europe... I just came back from Italy, where I was in Venice, Florence, and Rome on this trip, and it's pretty interesting to take a train. The impressive thing in Italy is how much emphasis they put on maintaining their agricultural land. You go on a train, you see these towns, which if you saw them in America, they'd be sprawled out 5 and 6 acre plots, and in Italy people live in apartment houses and little villages, and which leaves all the land open.
That's so interesting.
For agriculture, you know.
What about in China? Where did you live, and what? How do they build out their cities?
Well, I was recently in China for in Taiwan, in Beijing, and Shanghai. And I was raised in Shanghai till age of 10, and there are a couple of modern developments in China that are interesting and have a sort of a human scale. I think one of them is called Tsin Tsin Wa in Shanghai. But other than that, there's a real failure. Because the Chinese are just copying. In fact, they're hiring all the big architectural firms in America and around the world, and they're bringing them the same solutions they bring us, you know, which is huge scale that solves huge population problems, but totally disregards what's happening at 6 feet. So I always see these modern architectural projects as completely destroying the street, which I love and I think is so important.
Barry Jane Jacobs, preserve the energy of the streets at the expense of that open park that's just an empty field where if someone attacked you, no one would hear your screams.
Right. Streets are... For some reason, we like to be in cities, and as long as they're safe and They're wonderful places, you know. It's and I much always, more interesting than what's happening at a parking lot at a 7-Eleven out in the burbs.
For sure. I always studied in performance studies, which also looked at, that's where I got my master's in, and they looked at, you know, performance of space and performance of cities. It was interesting when, where do people stop? Like on the street, where do they stop? Where there's the most people. Right, yeah. Where people are crossing the street. That's where people will voluntarily stop and talk or right. speak on their phone. People tend towards other people.
Yeah.
It's a very basic phenomenon. I think surprised a lot of researchers when they did the studies. They figured, oh, he's going to go off into that empty doorway where he has some privacy. But right. no, he would gain privacy in public. And, of course, Irvin Goffman coined that term civil inattention. Where you're civil, but you're inattentive, because on a big city, if you were attentive to everyone, your mind would explode.
Yeah.
So, can you make some comparisons between Brooklyn, where we are broadcasting out of Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street in the Bushwick neighborhood of Brooklyn, and Berkeley?
Right. I think the trend is national that people are moving back into cities because life is so much more interesting in an urban environment than a suburban environment. Mm-hmm. And the suburbs, the people of your generation are just fleeing the suburbs. They want nothing to do with it. They're fifth generation victims at this point. And they're going to cities, and they'd rather live in a rusty old loft than a new condo high-rise. Mm-hmm. And what is that really about? And it's really about people seeking out an authentic life, and they want to be around authentic environments like Roberta's. Roberta's is an expression of a community of young builders and cooks and food and... The whole environment is an expression of their lives, of what they've done. And this is what young people love about cities, is that level of authenticity. And this is what they're looking for. Consequently, demand for city real estate has gone through the roof. It didn't even suffer in the downturn here in New York or San Francisco. And... there's not enough space to go around. So the outlying communities like Brooklyn, and I always call Oakland is San Francisco's Brooklyn.
It's Oakland, huh?
Yeah.
And Berkeley is our Queens? No. It's not. What is it?
Berkeley has always been this like academic Heights. Community, you know. It's yeah. been pretty isolated by itself. Not physically, just conceptually. And so... But Oakland is very much like Brooklyn, where local economy seems to be paramount and have a great deal of influence on the local businesses, on the economy, which is not so true in San Francisco, and which they're trying to corral and make more of it.
Well, we have a mutual friend, Renato Sardo.
Yes.
Who was put in charge of bringing businesses to Jack London Square, that massive, very challenging mm-hmm. space. And, you know, of course, he opened a few businesses and was like, oh, but then after a while it stopped. But to what you said earlier, it takes time. I mean, his work and the work yeah. success of that space could take 50 years.
Well, these developers weren't really too bright. They thought they could create the Ferry Building in San Francisco, which is a major food emporium and social hub for food people.
They also tried to do that in Napa with right by the right. American Institute of Wine right. and Food. It was called
Oxbow Market.
Oxbow Market, yeah, yeah. Where there's still, to this day, a couple dozen vendors.
Yeah, it but doesn't
Ferry really. Plaza is hard to... That's a big mistake people make, is they're successful once and they're like, let's just carbon copy it, but it doesn't work everywhere.
Well, there's a very interesting subtle truth about the Ferry Building. It would not have succeeded had they just opened it overnight. What people forget is for 10 years there was a farmer's market across the street mm-hmm. that was highly successful and very organic, in physically organic. And so when the Ferry Building opened, those customers just moved across the street. And
to the only sad person was, of course, that guy who owned the most profitable coffee house in the history of the world. Next to that farmer's market, there was only one guy serving coffee and croissant to everybody there. You literally had to walk 10, 15 blocks to get something. So I always felt bad for that guy. He was on the wrong place at the wrong time, although he did well for a number of years. Well, can you talk, you know, as a final question, I mean, you were so much the product of the 60s. You've started three radio stations. You got grants with that pattern language book and your friends and architecture. Can you talk about the influence of the 60s?
Yeah.
Berkeley and elsewhere?
In the 60s, if I look for a common thread amongst all my friends who come out of the 60s, and we all got involved in different professions and different things, is there was a pursuit of excellence. And I think, you know, Alice Waters, if there's one quality she has, that she just won't give up until she has excellence. And and I think there are a lot of people from the 60s, that was the lesson, that we're not going to sell out, we're going to do what we're passionate about. And I think some of that rubbed off on me and all the people I know in Berkeley. I mean, that's the common quality. There were other qualities in economics. We were reading a book called Small is Beautiful by an economist, Schrumpeter, who talks about local economy and small businesses and what they add to community, etc.
Very, very interesting. And now tell us about these three radio stations. What was
well, Berkeley, Berkeley pioneered subscription radio with KPFA. It was
KPFA.
Yes, it was a Pacifica network. In response to the House Un-American Activities Committee and
which
McCarthyism
was?
In the early 50s.
Hunting down communists.
Right. There's a man named Hill, I think Phil Hill was his name, who you would take a subscription to a radio station, he would send you an FM receiver because they weren't available. And that was a free band that he was broadcasting on. And that was the beginning of public radio in America.
Really? So and Phil Hill started
I think it's Phil. It's a Mr. Hill. Started subscription radio on FM. He was the first station on FM. You had to, with your subscription, you got a FM receiver. And that was in the early 50s, late 40s, and that went on to build the Pacifica Network, which is in Oregon and L.A. and New York and in various parts of the country. And our firm did the three of the radio stations for that network here in New York and in Berkeley, KPFA, in New York, WBAI, and KPFK in Los Angeles.
Well, so fascinating. I mean, now we should do more research about this history because, you know, we're just on the internet. I mean, those guys were giving people equipment and, you know, on the radar and this and that. So, well, it's always an honor. We've been friends for over a decade, and I hope it continues for many more decades. I learned a lot from you, and you've always followed avidly, you know, what Heritage has done, and you were the biggest advocate for the radio right from the beginning. So thank you for believing in the team and for all of your advice, and I hope you come on. We could probably go 3-4 more hours on different topics. Like, we didn't even ask you about food. For the record, Denny has eaten out almost every night since the early 80s. So you have to think of 80s, 90s, zeros, and now till 2012. Imagine the stories there. So we have to have you back.
It's over 18,000 meals in a row out.
18,000 meals in a row out. It's, Joe is like, I ordered pizza. I've gone out to raise pizza three nights in a row. I have a long way to go.
One day,
Joe, you'll do it. I eat out a lot, but well, I'm amazed how you're able to eat healthy doing that. When I go out, I'm ordering steaks and cheeseburgers. Denny looks like a young 22-year-old right here, even after all those meals. Well, thanks for listening. We're going to have some big guests on the main course coming up this holiday season. And congratulations to Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee and Joe Galarraga for a great first annual membership party. And stay tuned. Miles.
Yes, Patty, how are you?
Very good, very good. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes off of your busy schedule to talk with us.
Not a problem. My pleasure.
Man, we just had Denny Abrams on. Ooh, that was interesting. It was so interesting, you know, to think about these things. I mean, it basically is the source of happiness to be able to walk down the street and look around and gain pleasure from things. Now, your restaurant, I mean, we've known each other for years, so but your current restaurant is located on one of these beautiful little strips of energy, and inside Jupiter's Doors is a massive pulsating culture of brew making and interesting cooking. So congratulations on that gig, and tell us what Jupiter is about, just to contextualize what you do now.
Well, like, structurally, it's a turn of the century building. It used to be like a stagecoach or something, and so it's just massive. There's an outdoor patio that has these trumpet vines everywhere. It's very European feel to it. It's gorgeous. You kind of forget where you are. But inside, like, the most of the decor has been bought from churches that have closed. So it's some pretty cool, funky mix of things. But I mean, we're wildly busy. We're smacked right in between a BART station, which is our underground, and UC Berkeley. So the location is just prime.
Now, you are building your menu around a diverse microbrewery tradition that exists at that place, right?
Yeah, we own Drake's Brewery, which is becoming one of the bigger names in the East Bay. So we make our own beer, and we obviously make our own pizza, and we sold like $22,000 worth of each last night. It's just, it's really, really busy.
But you still manage to source from lame, pathetic, stupid, hard-to-get-along-with companies like Heritage Foods and other companies. So how do you juggle consistency with, you know, sourcing for a place that's going to generate a couple hundred covers a night? I mean, 500 more.
Yeah. Well, what's unique about Jupiter is that we only have pizza ovens. I have like three different pizza ovens, three different sizes, one gas, two wood, and I burn French oak, no, American oak. And I don't have a fryer, I don't have a grill, I don't have saute, I don't have a freezer. It's everything comes out of the pizza ovens. So that's quite a challenge, but it's quite fun as well.
Very interesting. Well, now, I don't know how many other cities you've worked in, but I mean, do you feel that you do things differently than other people in your position would do based off of it being a primarily Berkeley clientele?
No, it's pretty, standard, you know. Being in Berkeley, people think about Berkeley that everyone, you know, eats granola, smokes weed, and listens to the Grateful Dead. And, you know, there is that aspect, but it's
and
not.
The difference with you is that you don't like the, you're more of a Pink Floyd guy, right?
Yeah. cure or something like that. But I don't know. I think I'm getting off the track a little bit. But it's what makes us popular is our price points and our what we offer. It's like when I first started working in San Francisco, it was either fine dining or fast food. And when I was 16, I worked prep at Stars for Jeremiah Tower. And actually, we were just talking about Emily Lucetti. She was on like one of your first radio shows, and she was. I worked with her too.
Interesting.
One thing about working out here is it is incredibly incestuous. You know, it's such a small area.
I was going to ask that. What is the subculture of chefs? So I know that there's dozens of great restaurants throughout the East Bay and San Francisco. But talk about that subculture of sous chefs and roving chefs and chefs that get jobs but might not have one now. What is the culture of chefs? I certainly, we talk about it all the time in New York City when we have all these New York chefs on, but can you shed a light, a lens into the world of chef culture in California, Northern California?
Well, there's a lot of competition, and the economy's not that great. Like, even on, popular streets out here in Berkeley, there's still places for rent left and right. There's still restaurants closing left and right. And so I think now, like, when I first started out, I could get a job, like, you know, anytime I wanted, or, you know, I would stay somewhere for maybe a year or two and then just go on to try to get some more experience and whatnot. But now I think people are kind of, you know, anchoring in and trying to make it last longer than they normally would have. Because, I mean, there still is fine dining, of course, but it's not half as much as, say, you know, 20 years ago. You know, people are going for more casual neighborhood kind of places. And actually, a lot of people from San Francisco are moving outside of San Francisco to open up places.
Yeah, it seems ironically, if you were to say, a friend of mine has a pub in New York, I'd be like, oh my God, it's like saying you have a pub in London. But that somehow in Berkeley you have a pub. Yeah, it would almost seem like you would have less competition because everybody is trying to be like a Chez Panisse or something like that. But I guess that's just a stereotype. I mean, San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley are still cities just like everybody else, with baseball fans and football fans and burger eating. And
right.
Or is it different?
Well, that's what I was trying to get at about, you know, what people think of as Berkeley if they've never been here. You know, it's not all Chez Panisse. You know, I even thought that when I first came over. And, you know, there are people that are trying to find, you know, humanely raised anti-hormones and antibiotic-free meat, but it's not across the board. And one thing that I felt kind of disheartened about is that I went to this one place, and they were boasting that, you know, they had this such and such quality of meat, and it was only, like, on one item out of, like, 20 on the menu. Mm-hmm. So it's being used, like, how the word, like, sustainable or organic or, you know, or it's being stretched, you know?
Very interesting. So, can you give us a lens into having two children and still being a chef at a restaurant that turns a lot of people? I mean, how do you juggle it?
I am blessed with a very understanding wife and two gorgeous kids. And I can have the kids in the restaurant at any time. You know, it's a family place, more or less. And I've got insanely good hours. I work just a couple nights, and I have Sunday, Monday off, so it's working.
I've always been struck. I've known you through a restaurant that you worked with before, and now Jupiter, how organized you keep things. If I was an owner, I would be beyond happy knowing that you were at the helm, because you basically, it seems like your goal, for selfish reasons, but also for the owner, is to basically make things work like clockwork.
Well, you're very sweet. I think one thing that I do well is I make a hard job look really easy, and I pride myself in that.
Yeah, while still managing to consume all those drugs and still run a successful business and family.
You'd think that I'd be dead a long time ago.
Well, Miles, you know, you really could have a column on my show. Just call in and, you know, musings from Miles.
That's good.
One of the top three or four funniest people I've ever met through my work at Heritage. And, you know, I especially remember with fond memories our trip to Kansas, visiting all the farms and sleeping on couches. And
shooting guns.
Yeah, shooting guns, not at each other, but at everyone will be happy to know at innocent livestock. So nothing to worry about.
Right, yeah. And, we're shooting cans.
We were shooting cans. That's C-A-N-S. Joe, if you could tag that. And so anyway, we shouldn't make this so irregular. You should be coming on and we should develop terroir for ourselves here on Heritage Radio. And that's
like
Jupiter.
Musings with Miles. That has a nice ring to it.
Musings with Miles. Can you muse your address, website address for the for the listeners out there?
I would imagine it's just jupiter.com.
I think the planet got that actually. One.
But yeah, just hit Jupiter Berkeley and you'll find it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. And thanks everyone for listening. And we will be back next week with equally good show, hopefully. So thanks for listening. Thanks, Miles.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.